Hello, this is a science podcast where I talk basically off the top of my head, and we'll try and explain a year eight or for 13-year-olds at in Australian schools, but obviously at a much deeper level, the idea of elements, metals, and non-metals. You can basically break up all 82 stable or 100 stable and unstable elements into these two categories. This is a podcast of Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. It's plover. Sorry, a bird. It looked a bit like a penguin. There's no way that a penguin would be this far inland. Yeah, look, so it's basically a podcast where I do my cardiac rehabilitation walk, and I'll bump into people, bits of wildlife. You'll hear the occasional sound. I think at the moment you might be able to hear a jet going over the top. I just walk through the streets of the village up at the Blue Mountains. This is sort of a special village, so the Blue Mountains are mountains behind Sydney, Australia. They've risen up an old ancient riverbed, which has gone over a hot spot on the Earth's crust and uplifted. And the region where I'm at is uplifted most recently, only a few million years ago, and it's created a little hidden valley. And in the hidden valley, nestled in the hidden valley, is the village of Glenbrook. And I'm going for a walk on the gentle hills up here. There's actually quite steep hills and cliffs and canyons around here, but the actual village itself is nestled in a fairly smoothly undulating sandstone hills. Okay, so we're getting back onto the idea of elements, metals, and non-metals. Now, I'm obviously going to go into it for a fair amount of quantum physics to describe what's going on. Firstly, we have to discuss what is an atom. And now, an atom consists of electrons, and a nucleus. The electrons are negatively charged, and you get a series of individual negatively charged electrons, and they are attracted to a positively charged nucleus. Now, the nucleus is 1/1,000,000th the size of an atom. It's very, very small. It's a tiny little speck of matter on the inside, and that's where all the mass of the nucleus is. Now, in general, people have said, oh, well, if that's all the mass is, the electrons are lighter, there's got to be a lot more small. However, if you just bear with science for long enough and do the Schrodinger wave equation, you'll come up with this amazing fact that the atom is full of electron. In fact, it's one electron will fill up the entire atom. The next electron will actually float through the first electron and fill it up again. But the nucleus, which has got all the mass, the more massive something is, the smaller it is. It's roughly 2,000 times more massive than an electron, and that means for every dimension it's 2,000th the size of it. You could get a 2-meter ruler, and the nucleus would be, the width of that would be roughly 1 millimeter compared to that. And of course, it would be the size of 1 millimeter, like a small little ball bearing inside a very large beach ball, taller than yourself. So if you're 1 meter tall, you're a 14-year-old, you're probably about 1 meter at this stage, so you're standing to an end. A ball, a fairly large ball, so it's small but imaginable, and often the figures are hard to imagine, but it's 1 to 2,000 roughly is the mass ratio between a proton and an electron. Now, we'll get into it. So the nucleus, an electron can have a charge of minus, or has a charge of minus 1, whereas a nucleus is a little ball, and it can have any charge. It can have a charge up to 82 or 100. And it's a little ball, pretty much the same size all the time, and it can just build up this entire charge. And we have the general idea is that a neutral atom has an equal number of electrons to the number of protons, or the charge in the nucleus. So a nucleus's charge is determined by the number of protons in that nucleus. Now we're going to stop a little bit and say that the common thought is that a neutral atom will have a the same number of negative electrons as positive charge. But if you you can actually have a stable charged atom, that is, it has a different number of electrons to the number of protons. Now, it's fairly easy to see that if you remove an electron, you will have a positively charged atom. Now, that's quite easy to sort of understand. It's your electrons have been removed from it, so overall it wants another electron. But you have another idea that you can have an atom which has got a negative charge attached to it. And now this is rather hard to see, because why would a negative charge hang around a neutral atom? There's a car just zooming past there. Why would a negative charge hang around a neutral atom? Now, again, the answer to this is, I suppose you can intimidate kids and say it does, or talk about the shells and fact that, at least for small atoms, you require a shell. A complete shell has 8 electrons in it. We won't go into that too much. But the real reason is that electrons do fill the entire atom, and they do have shape. And as you fill them in, they're sort of like a jigsaw puzzle piece which fits in, and they sort of paint the area around the nucleus with negative charge, but they paint it in a non-symmetrical way. Well, it is a symmetrical way, but it doesn't cover all areas. So you can actually have an area of the atom which at close range, when you come close enough of it, you can actually see the positive nucleus. And if you're an electron, you can actually push into this region of local positive charge and actually slip in and actually make a stable negatively charged ion. So you can have O minus, O2 minus, or F minus. These little ions can actually float around the atmosphere and hit against water molecules, or atmospheric gas, and there could be ions floating in the gas. It's monatomic ions floating in the gas. So that's one of the mysteries. And obviously, for year 8, you don't obviously go into that area. One of the things I want to do is get down to the basics of what a nucleus actually really does look like. Now, people will tell you, well, obviously, it looks like the 1936 Bohr liquid drop atom, which I think the scientific community abandoned in 1936. But it was a beautiful model. It was an easy teaching model, and it showed the nucleus as a bunch of grapes, basically, of typically blue and red-coloured grapes. I think the blue are the neutrons, and the reds are typically the protons. And they're a little bunch of balls going together. Now, obviously, this would have a number of technical problems as into what is the strong nuclear force. This is the force which binds neutrons and protons together. So that would have a problem, because to have two spheres not passing through each other, they must have a repulsive force, and the strong nuclear force doesn't have a repulsive term in it, so mathematically it can't be correct, and logically it can't be correct, because an assembly of balls can have different energies depending on how you actually stack them together. So you'd have not a unique energy for a nucleus with these very fine radiation lines, you just have a mess. And this is the classical mechanics area. I've just come up a hill, I'm a bit breathless at the moment. So you could tell pretty easily, pretty quickly, within a couple of minutes of looking at the ball liquid drop at nucleus, this is not the way. Now, people get actually quite offended when you say, look, particularly when you speak with people at nuclear reactors, people who have their daily lives drawing nucleuses of these little balls, coloured balls together, and neutrons coming off. So there's a lot of things which reinforce it. You can actually break a nucleus, fission a nucleus, and it breaks up into two parts, and you can actually count the parts. It's sort of like a cake, cutting it in half, and you can have these other balls fly off, neutrons which fly off. We'll get a little bit into neutrons and protons. So neutrons and protons are the fundamental particles which go in to a nucleus. They are particles, I suppose, because they have certain properties like a particle, but one of the particle properties they don't have is a solid surface and the ability to form this bunch of grapes or liquid drop model of the nucleus, which, as I've said before, has been discounted in 1936. Now, the actual model of the nucleus is actually a repeat of the quantum mechanical model of the atom. So, as I've said before, the electrons are not physical particles, and they don't stack together or orbit, they actually slide through each other. The same is true in the nucleus. Now, the nuclear model has got a fairly basic potential, and the actual dynamics of it can actually be fitted fairly quickly. You get the general shape of the potential energy well, the strong nuclear force attractive energy well, which is holding it together, you can actually tweak the shape very accurately to get the quantum energy levels in nuclear radiation. Just to give you, not to freak you out, I suppose, one of the things is that you can create a nucleus, cobalt, for instance, and you can actually add a neutron to it by putting cobalt in a nuclear reactor, and that neutron will sit in the sink into the cobalt nucleus, and it'll be of a shape which is symmetry forbidden to actually go down to its bottom shape. So you're gonna have to get used to it. Neutrons and protons have shapes similar to electrons, in fact I suppose identical to electrons, but on a much smaller scale. And radiation, or gamma radiation at least, it comes from these particles changing shape. and a dipole transition moment. This is when the charges and the nucleus rearrange themselves in order to go to a lower energy level. Now, at least for cobalt, comes in with a shape which is not allowed, doesn't have the symmetry in our universe, so to speak, to actually go to the lower space. So it can't just automatically go there quickly in the blink of an eye. It has to last for months or years, and then when it does so, it goes and goes there through a sort of a magical two-step process and produces two medium energy gamma rays. And so cobalt, for instance, is one of these wonder radioactive nuclei which produces two gamma rays. It decays by giving two gamma rays, but over a very long lifetime. And so you can basically store nuclear energy in cobalt and make little cobalt balls, and take the balls in a container, ball bearings in a container, and use it as a cobalt radiation source. Get a little convenient portable gamma ray source. Now, there's heaps of sources similar to that. This is particularly interesting because it's a metastable transition, and you get a whole heap of metastable transitions. But let's go back to it. The actual potential well that you draw, so if you can imagine drawing a U shape on the page, this is for the strong nuclear force, and name of the potential is not an inverse square potential as for a nucleus. It's actually a modified potential of the I can never pronounce it. I've only ever read it, but the actual one where you get in there with I suppose a supercomputer, but nowadays it's probably a desktop, and calculate the shape of it, is the Saxon Wood potential. And basically it's just a fairly rough modified exponential for the shape, and then what you do is you throw in a few actual experimental data lines and actually tweak up the shape of this potential for the number of neutrons and protons. It's, I suppose, called a semi-empirical method, what this basically does is that if you get if you model for two or three nuclear radiation lines, you can get the whole lot in exquisite detail. And this potential also explains particle decay. This potential, if you imagine, is like a raised dam wall filled up with water, and it's like a well fill up with water, but it's actually filled above ground level up to the well, and that can leak particles, neutrons and protons, or alpha particles, which we'll get into apart from here. This is obviously going a long way from year 8, and I suppose this gives some of the fundamental problem you have if you're a quantum physicist and you're stuck in a classroom. You have a lot of more things going in your head when you want to explain something. You give up and just basically draw the standard shape. I'll have to actually go on some classic lessons where I teach with chocolate, different types of chocolate, the nucleus. And I just don't, I really don't bother trying to teach it then. Your first proton, say a hydrogen is a single proton in this potential. It's not really got a potential, it's not binding with each other. If you add a neutron to it, you get deuterium. It's got one charge, and the number of protons in the nucleus is the number of, is the element An element, saying a element is equivalent, something is an element, is by saying that has a fixed number of protons, it's got a fixed charge, and therefore it's got, so I could, instead of replace the word element with fixed number of protons, I could replace it. Every time I say elements, I could say that material there, all that material there, has a fixed number of protons. Or the particle here is a particular element, it's a particular fixed charge number of protons. So deuterium with one proton and one neutron is still the element hydrogen. Now, although people often draw, or they always draw, deuterium as a blue circle and a yellow circle just sticking together, that strong nuclear force is like two magnets, but the actual fact, the neutron actually is like a ghost all the way through the proton. So the proton and the neutron exist in the same region of space. They don't exist. You have to draw the coordinate of the neutron and the proton with respect to the nucleus, where the centre of the nucleus is 0, 0, 0, x, y, z. The neutron and the proton would also share that same coordinate. There's no spatial displacement between the two. And in fact, the neutron actually is actually through the proton. And, going up here. Now, just to step back, a neutron has no charge, and a neutron, this is something that, look, I really must admit, I've never had one teacher who's known this straight. I don't know how they teach nuclear physics at high school, but a neutron will travel through normal matter, so particularly if I've got armor or anything like that, if I have a beam of neutrons, it will just waltz through. Oh, sorry, there's a huge spider here. Oops. Just going to walk around this. Oh, there it is. Okay. Saw that one coming. So I'm walking through the streets rather than the bush, but there's still occasionally these huge spiders. When I say huge spiders, I don't know. This is, I don't know, it's a nickel, a dime. They're sort of fairly big. It's the size of your thumb. There you go. Yeah, they're pretty big, these spiders. Say neutrons. If I had a cup of neutrons, what would happen is that they would fall through the cup, through the table, and go down through the earth until they actually encountered, slowed down. As they slow down, they change size. This is a whole heap of things to get your mind around. That a slow neutron, thermal neutron, will achieve a fairly large size, and it will hit water. And when it hits water in the ground, so if I have neutrons in a cup of neutrons, what will happen is that they'll fall through my hand, fall through the air, fall through the earth and go down, hit the water table, and when it hits the water table, they'll form deuterium, and when they form deuterium, they'll emit gamma rays. So this is one way that you can detect water. You just get a couple of neutrons and pour it out anywhere and have your gamma ray detectors sitting at angles, because they come out at all angles. You can actually just map where the water is with neutrons. So your deuterium, rather than what looks like in the textbooks, have been two little balls, is actually, if you like, one grey ball, where the neutron and proton actually glide through each other. Now, the next element up is that we can add to this another proton. So it's two protons and a neutron, and you'd say there, well, two protons, at least that second proton wouldn't glide through, but it has one trick up its sleeve. So this is helium-3. Helium is an element, and when I say it's an element, it's one way of saying it's got a certain number of protons. And so when I say something is helium, I'm saying everything in that balloon or that particular atom which I can point at, when I say it's helium, in another way I'm saying, look, that's got two protons in it. It's got a plus charge. Now that helium-3, so I want you to imagine in old money, that's got, two red and a blue little balls. Now, what it is quite spectacular. It's got simply one area, because you can have the same shape but a different spin. Now, this is something to get your mind around. So, in quantum physics and science, yeah, I suppose it comes from quantum physics, comes from relativistic physics. When Dirac, real great man, Dirac, quite a stylish guy, when he did the space-time coordinates for quantum mechanics, he had x, y, z, and time. You convert that, he still gets a four-point matrix, and the four-point matrix gives you for a particle, a spin-up particle, a spin-down particle, a matter particle, and an antimatter particle. So he actually discovered these exotic things, which it's hard to get your mind around, matter and antimatter. I sort of can understand that from quantum chromodynamics, but from spin. So you've got two spins, you can have things having only spin up or spin down. These particles have spin up, spin down, and essentially it's from a higher dimension of matter, and the only really good our-dimensional analogue of it is a Möbius strip. So this is a piece of paper, you cut it out, give it a twist, stick it together, and you have something called a Möbius strip. I'm going to have to apologise, we've got one of these coal trains roaring through here. I'm just walking up over a rail bridge. So I don't know whether you can hear it. There's a canyon which goes from Sydney up into the Blue Mountains. Like, this is a genuine canyon. It's sort of hard to imagine. You don't expect a canyon to go through a mountain and come out into a plain. That's pretty wild idea. So what's actually happened is that this is a creek minding its own business, and the actual sandstone's uplifted either side of it. So the creek has kept its path, and the hills have grown either side of it. And oh, that was a rather quick coal train, so you're spared on that one. Yeah, so we're just getting into your second proton in is a spin down proton. You've got a spin up proton and spin down proton, and your little nucleus here. So we're going to get to the elements eventually here, but this is just a chat, and if you listen to it, it might help you understand. The Möbius strip, you give it a twist, you can have a clockwise or anti-clockwise strip twist as you're holding it and you're gluing it together, and this gives you an S2 symmetry, or also known as 720 degrees symmetry. Look it up on the internet. I've got a car coming up here. I'm coming up to the national park. I don't know what this guy's doing, because the national park's locked. It's probably the police. So we're going across here. Oops. No, it's not the police. I don't know what that car's doing. So the police go around checking the national park entrances, and I don't know, it's just got a fairly standard route. So earlier on when I was doing my very basic cardiac rehabilitation, I'd be out here in the freezing cold. So down in the canyons, there's a cold body of massive air which sits up the mountains, and then it just roars this cold wind down the canyons, and you're there with a blanket on your head just doing this cardiac rehab walk. And when you first started the operation, it's really half a foot in front of each other right through the night, because you can't do it during the day, it's too much traffic, and the police are going up and down and cheering you on, sort of just checking that you're not completely mad. Strange, I think I encountered other people doing rehab. Now this car's going up here. Okay, so we're just trying not to get run over here. Okay, so basically the universe is divided into, this is the way it is. There's spin up universe and spin down universe, and the two are superimposed on each other. So at close range, a spin up electron can actually sit all the way through a spin down electron. It's so true for helium. Your two protons, one spin up, spin down, they sit over each other, a beautiful Gaussian fluffy ball. In Australia, we have this thing called a Nerf ball. I don't know whether you have it. I suppose you have Nerf guns, so that's where it's probably come from. The material, sort of a soft ball. Again, in quantum mechanics, there's no surfaces, so this is why you immediately go cringe when you look at the Bohr model that has surfaces, and you say, well, that's not going to work. So I'm going up here. I'll just walk through here. I think that car was actually expecting to get through this gate. I just looked at the way where it went here, and I've got a look at the gate. Oh, okay. That was the domestic dog barking. Sorry, you got to listen out for dingoes. There are actually a population of dingoes in the national park, and for some reason, they're not interbreeding at all with domestic dogs. So that's a thesis. So you can hear a domestic dog barking. Okay, getting back to the quantum physics. So you've got spin up, spin down. And when you actually make a helium nucleus, it's just has uniform matter through it, and it drops off exponentially squared, gassing away, and you have the spin up, the spin down proton, the spin up and spin down neutron. So we've gone to helium 4, that is, it's got 4 particles, and helium, when I say helium, I say that's code for 2 protons here, mate. So you're nucleuses, I just sort of get that out. I'm just rambling on at the moment. The nucleuses are not as you see in the textbooks. They are just uniform through. Now, the next one up, lithium, the next proton, actually has to have a twist in it. So if you imagine a balloon, it's got a twist. It's got to have a higher symmetry. And that sits in the nucleus. Now, it has, the nucleus has positive charge, but it's also got a strong nuclear force, so a very short range, due to the exchange of the gluons between the quarks, or you could call it resonances. If you look at the Feynman diagrams, this is short range force, so the actual particle brings with it its own binding energy, basically you have a recipe for strong nuclear force, and you have something like starts off, it's roughly 2 neutrons for every proton, so uranium 235 is just trying to think, what's the 92? So that gives you the rough ratio there. So it's a little bit more than one. I think it's probably around 30% more, this is just off my top of my head, more neutrons are necessary to get a stable nucleus. So there's always slightly higher number of neutrons in here. And in your surface is this, everything is sitting centrally. There's nothing offside in a nucleus. You have these quantum mechanical shapes sitting through each other. So your each element has a different number of protons, has a different charge. I suppose all I've said so far is that the nucleus doesn't look like the nucleus in your textbook. Now we come up to... it would therefore have a preferred number of electrons which it can hold, it can attract. And it's how it attracts the electrons which determines whether it's a metal or non-metal. Okay, that's safe. This is quite a brilliant night at the moment. Essentially, now this will blow a lot of people's minds. If it's a non-metal, two atoms can come together and share their electrons in such a way that they form either binding or anti-binding bonds or molecular orbitals. And this is basically splitting up the nucleus and comparing. So you've got a supernucleus of two elements sticking together, and the electron can actually sit. You notice how a fluorine atom can appear positive at close range. Well, if you can get two atoms which are locally positive, you can align those two positives up and actually get an electron to actually be trapped in between those two positives. That's basically a covalent bond. And that's a localized bond. Now, that's non-metal elements such as fluorine, chlorine. I suppose your noble gases might be up there under the non-metal ones. The electrons, when they bond or stick together, they can sort of share or align themselves, so they can locally expose their positive regions, and pull in electrons into that region, and so that sort of create a sort of localized trap for electrons. That's a way of talking about a positive molecular or bonding molecular orbitals. But for atoms, it's a bit different in that the electrons are not always s orbital circular orbital electrons. They basically don't see this. They see an inner charged ion. This is why I began talking about ions at the very start. And they're on the outside. And so the two metals can stick together and it can form a molecular orbital which forms basically an electron paste around the outside with these two positive charges in between. If you can imagine metals have positive charges with an electron glue on the outside, and they can two positive charges, they can come close together because they're shielded and create a basic well in which this electron can exist. Now, what this means, again, it's again quantum mechanics, for each atom you bring into this party, you create a greater positive charge and greater C of, I suppose, I don't like the term C, but soup of electrons on the outside. And the electron, which was the size of the atom, expands in size to the size of the molecule, two or three, and eventually your electron will grow in size to the size of all the atoms together. And so, indeed, according to quantum mechanics, your electron grows, becomes more convoluted and I suppose fluttery, one way to describe it. It thinned out, but it grows in size to the size of all your atoms. And indeed, electrons are the size of your crystal, at least. Your electrons grow in size till you can actually see them. And look, you can see them, say, if you hold your spoon or a fork and you look at the silver, that silver there, that's not the colour of an atom. That's the colour of electrons. The electron C responds to the radiation and bounces it back. So you're... in a non-metal, the electrons are confined into a sort of little trap, positive trap, between the atoms, and that actually glues the atoms together. In a metal, the atoms, the reverse atoms, and the atoms are in a trap of electrons, which are very elastic and large, and they can keep on growing in size. That's a bat. It's not a happy bat up there. Okay, so just coming back again. It's hard to get your mind around. If you don't go this route, and electrons growing in size, sort of cut yourself off from silicon and other things like that. So you've got this electron goo, and people, are taught to rote learn that a metal has these properties. They conduct electricity. Well, yes, of course they do, because they've got big electrons, so you can push a big electron in and out. They are malleable. Yes, they do. Obviously, the electrons... Oh, shit. Sorry. I shouldn't have said that. That was a big spider web. I have to be careful going through here, because this is a dark, dark region. I nearly got one on my face. Yes, of course they're malleable, because the electrons themselves can change shape, and they're actually trapping the metal together. They're sort of like... There's an electron cage of positive ions in it. They're shiny. Yes, of course they're shiny, because that's the picture of electrons on the outside. Electrons are matter, where the electrons are on the outside and able to, as basically a kind of fluid. And so the classic way is that you sort of teach it in reverse. You say, A, B, C are metals. What's all common with them? Oh, look, they're all malleable, they're all shiny, they're all, I've got this. Therefore, I've understood how it goes. And here's this model. It's got these traps in it, but I'm going to tell you what the traps are. And that's it. And have you understood? Oh, well, look, I'll give you a test. Look, have you recited what the properties of metals are? Good. Have you drawn the model that I've shown you? good. That's with these positive cores and electrons travelling on the outside for no particular reason. I think there's the drawn at school is the Drude model from 1901. There's a Drude model which shows these positive cores and electrons as tiny little flies flying through it as a sea of electrons, and that would, I think, it Drude, similar to the Bohr liquid drop model, the Drude model only lasted a very, very short time, and that models electrons as these tiny little dots, these classical dots, which people soon realised was not possible, and that sort of explains, I think, charge current in a atom. It doesn't explain malleability or the luster. And so this is the Drude model, look it up, D-R-U-D-E, yeah, Drude model, and that explains it. So let's pull back in summary. We've got a year 8 class, obviously I can't explain it to them like this, I'll get sacked immediately, but we've got to say the elements. So to summarise again, the elements is the atoms broken up into groups with a fixed number of protons or fixed charge in the nucleus. So you have to begin to describe that an atom is a nucleus and electrons. So it's hard to do that. Sorry, and that's a passenger train coming through, goes down the gorge. Absolutely, in the morning, when it's dawning, you go through this, and it is actually a spectacular view each day as you go through it. So you go the elements, basically you say, the way it's generally taught is, look, if you look at these are properties, and you sort of rote learn them to say, look, if it's like this, it's a metal, it's on this side of the periodic table. If it's getting towards the other side of the periodic table, it's a non-metal. It tends to be powdery, dry, not metal-like. Metal, not metal-like. And, of course, the non-metals have the property of having basically pits. Just listen to it. There's a wallaby, someone's front garden. Don't know, I just heard it moving. Okay. Yep. No. Yep. Just having a look at it. Now it's you get greys into the centre of the national park. Really, it depends. Eastern grey, and then just around the canyons up here, you get individual wallabies, and they tend to, both of them, kangaroos around the tend to be the day and dusk, whereas wallabies are really nocturnal, solitary nocturnal animals, and all the times when people spot wallabies, like a wallaby on the Harbour Bridge, which just happened recently, it's at night time. They tend to move around around at night time. So this one's a little black-faced wallabies, quite nice ones, and they often, when you're in the bush and you're quiet, they'll be minding their own business. They'll come up and go the opposite direction. There's a lot of science to get behind. Just avoiding another fairly light spiderweb. Oh, then yeah, there's a lot of science in here, and you just really have to question this on a number of levels. So you can teach sort of folklore science, and you really have to do it. It's just that people get really easily offended if you actually teach or show understanding of the quantum mechanics, and I think people are shocked that, you know, the quantum mechanics has worked for the electrons. I accept that, but surely it can't be quantum mechanical in the nucleus. And of course, basically the same physics works for the nucleus as well. There's sort of a idea to protect people from learning about spin, spin up, spin down, the symmetries of the universe, and basically the Schrodinger wave equation. But there is actually not a lot of I suppose a fair amount of science in the maths getting around here, but the actual conclusions are fairly simple. So the spin up, spin down spin oars are pretty easy to manipulate, and the Schrodinger wave equation is actually quite easy to operate. And obviously you can't teach it to young kids, but it's not all that hard. It's a nice thing to do. So that brings me to the end of this podcast, as I'm going back up the hills. Hopefully I'll talk to you okay. Next talk I might give is about special cooling mechanisms in molecules. That's just astoundingly interesting. So I gave a talk on snowflakes, and this is just a broad introduction to the periodic table and the basic properties. And probably the next talk I'll give, or podcast, will be just to talk about the way that molecules can actually, I suppose, dance with electrons and reject electrons and do pretty amazing things. But that's all for now. That's Peter Hill Explains, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.